Well, hi everyone, and good morning. Beautiful day. I always plan these thyroid classes for the worst possible weather because you usually get a little thyroid jolt by that time, but I guess you're just going to have to wait a couple weeks. Anyway, thank all of you for coming this morning. It is, I've been giving thyroid classes once a year at least for probably the past 20 years. And for those of you who know me, I've probably commented a number of times that I can't stand giving the same class on anything twice. But I find it quite interesting that every year when it comes time to prepare for the thyroid class, I always get really excited about it because there's always something new in the world of thyroid. The new era of gene science is opening up an absolute amazing array of new information relating to your thyroid, how it's functioning, what it's actually doing, and even more importantly, what you can do about it. So I've been working with this subject now easily for 20 years or more. I was probably the first one to put selenium in a thyroid supplement. And you go, well, why did this guy do that? Well, I used to, before the internet, and I could just live in the National Library of Medicine's database, I used to buy arcane scientific books that nobody else bought, and I'd read them. So I was working with thyroid, so I'd buy a book on the thyroid, and I read all about it. And sure enough, there was a chapter, I remember, some 20-odd years ago, where the selenoproteins were required to activate thyroid hormone. I said, oh, that's amazing. Never heard of that before. And so, of course, I put selenium in a thyroid supplement, that which became Thyroid Helper, of course. And now everybody puts selenium in thyroid supplements. So, you know, I'm always on, you might say, the cutting edge of what's new, and bringing it to you typically a decade or two ahead of everybody else. In my field, as far as the medical field goes, it could be a century before they catch on to what's going on. There is a humongous disconnect between the science of thyroid research and what happens in a physician's office, even an endocrinologist's office. And so that means that you, the person, you, the patient, you, the individual trying to take better care of yourself, your best option for understanding more about what's going on with your body is to actually understand the subject in a little bit more depth than you would get from talking to a doctor or from looking around on the internet at some of the, lay people and so on who are talking about thyroid. Because you see, they're kind of obsessed with which thyroid hormone you should be taking and what form of T3 is best and where you're going to get your T, they're just kind of overly obsessed with hormone replacement, which at best is a credit card, and at worst makes your thyroid system worse, which is more common than help. So we need to understand what this subject is all about, and we need to understand it in a little bit more depth than just basic, I'm cold, my hair is falling out, my skin is dry, my eyebrows are falling off, different things that go on with the thyroid. So we have to kind of include it in a picture that's a little bit more expanded in terms of your understanding. So I am going to just go over for you the basics of thyroid hormone function so that we're all on the same page. And then I'm going to delve into some of the newer discoveries that are going on, which I, of course, find quite fascinating, and I think you will too, and hopefully it'll tie some things together with you. So let's just go on a journey of thyroid hormone around your body and start at that point. The first thing to understand, the first signal that decides to make thyroid hormone actually occurs in your hypothalamus gland of your brain. That's your subconscious command and control center. And it is sensing things all over your body. So a lot of things come up in your blood, and one of those is what's going on with the thyroid at the cellular level. So your brain predicts what's going on elsewhere. Your subconscious brain does not have two eyeballs to look down and see how each cell is doing with thyroid. It has to guesstimate based on the signals coming back to it. So the signal in your brain, the subconscious brain, is called thyroid releasing hormone, or TRH for short. And this turns out to be a extremely important signal, and I'm going to be talking a lot more about it later. But right now, the point about TRH is it starts the whole process of your formation of thyroid hormone. It requires activating amino acids to stimulate its production. Those would be nutrients like tyrosine or phenylalanine, things that help these sympathetic nerves activate are required for TRH production. B vitamins are cofactors, especially B6, B12, and folic acid. So they're critically important. And absolutely essential is the hormone leptin, which actually is involved with TRH gene transcription, which means essentially that unless leptin tells TRH to form, it isn't going to form. And so if you have leptin resistance and leptin isn't getting into your brain, or if you are truly starving or anorexic or in a weakened physical condition and have low leptin, not from being overweight, but from being underweight and in a more feeble condition, TRH is going to be set very low as if you're in hibernation metabolism. That is, of course, because your brain thinks you're starving. So whether that's real or imaginary, that's a key input to getting thyroid hormone going in the first place. Now, TRH sends its message down to your pituitary gland, which sits right below it. Again, part of the limbic system, subconscious aspects of your command and control center. You wouldn't want to have to think about these things. That's why they're subconscious. If you had to make a decision every morning about what your thyroid gland is going to do for you, you might forget, and then you might conk out. So, you know, your body takes care of all these things without you having to think about it. So TRH goes down and tells your pituitary to make thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH. And this is typically one of the scores you'll get on a lab test. They're measuring TSH. This is probably the only accurate thyroid test that there is that's actually well, that's not true. But it's actually measuring something that's realistic. And I'll explain that later. But the TSH score is a call from your subconscious brain down to your thyroid gland telling it to get in gear and start making thyroid hormone. And so that's the signal that's going down there. So when your TSH score on a lab test is elevated, that means that the signal or the order to get going thyroid is increasing. And that means your thyroid is struggling from your brain's point of view, because anytime the TSH is going up, then that means that your brain thinks the thyroid should be working harder. So that's what that means. And then if the TSH score is low, then it means that the signal coming from the brain to the thyroid, it's saying don't go faster. So typically low TSH is associated with hyperthyroid states, and high TSH is associated with hypothyroid states. But then we have many shades of gray. In other words, maybe the thyroid, despite who's yelling at it, still manages somehow to make enough hormones. So then the blood hormone levels look sort of in the normal range, yet the TSH is either high or low. These are functional problems, subclinical hyper or hypothyroidism, and many people struggle with some version of offness in the system, meaning you don't just go from completely healthy to, wow, I have hypo or hyperthyroidism, overnight. These are processes that take years. There are many factors that influence the system. And a struggling subclinical hypothyroid system, which is what many people suffer from as a constellation of metabolic problems, is associated with increased rates of cardiovascular disease and other problems. So this is a significant health issue independent of just simply your metabolism. Now, your thyroid gland produces thyroxine, which is called T4. And thyroxine is a molecule that has an amino acid called tyrosine in the middle of it, and it has four iodine molecules attached to the tyrosine. So the obviously, you need tyrosine and iodine to make thyroid hormone, and a lack of either one would be problematic from the point of view of forming the hormone in the first place, meaning you didn't have enough raw materials to make it. So once the T4 is produced, that is not active thyroid hormone. That is just a basic raw material hormone that the rest of your body can then convert into active thyroid hormone. The primary site of activation of thyroid hormone is actually in your liver. So your liver is the main area where you convert T4 to biologically active T3. This is where selenium is needed, because selenium activates the enzyme that chops off one of the iodine molecules. So T3 is essentially a tyrosine now with three iodines, and that's, you know, why we call it T3. So T3 is the biologically active form. Besides your liver, you can also activate T3 in your kidneys and your muscles, but those are secondary systems as far as your whole body is concerned. And in the context of thyroid hormone activation, the neck up and the neck down are two totally different issues. Your brain converts thyroid hormone differently entirely. So T4 enters your brain and is converted on a cell-by-cell basis into T3. So every single cell in your brain can activate thyroid hormone by itself. That is totally different than the rest of your body. And you might say, well, why is this? And my take on why it is because in early developmental periods, the biggest problem, of course, was starvation. And so if your metabolic rate for your entire body was kept at a higher level, you would, of course, perish because you wouldn't have enough food to keep stoking the furnaces of a faster metabolic rate. On the other hand, if your head was also in a sort of hibernation mode, you wouldn't have enough energy or desire to hunt food or go after food or even see potential food. So the head had to be kept awake at all costs during evolution, whereas the rest of the body could be turned down. And this is why thyroid regulation in your brain is different than thyroid regulation everywhere else in your body. Regardless of what we're talking about, you still have to activate T3, and it requires selenium everywhere in your body to do that. The T3, then, now we have this active hormone, and what it does is it binds onto a cell membrane. So, you know, you've got 100 trillion or more cells in your body. The T3 latches onto the outside of it, and then what's called a second messenger, it sends the T3 signal to the DNA of your cell, which is the inside, you know, the nucleus of the cell. That requires zinc. You have zinc involved in the transport of the thyroid within the cell, and you have zinc fingers, literally, that's what they're called, that project out of the DNA, and that's where the thyroid signal latches onto. So again, here's another mineral you've got to have adequate, which is zinc, and you know, majority of people are deficient in zinc, so that's an issue. Once the DNA receives the thyroid signal, that means to the DNA of a cell that, oh, we've got fuel, we've got food, and now we can actually do metabolic work because there's going to be raw materials there. So then the thyroid turns on the DNA of the cell, which immediately implements approximately 80 different gene signals telling the cell what to do. So now cells can work. Interestingly, iron is required for the function of those gene signals within the cell. Virtually all of them need iron. So if you're iron deficient, it doesn't matter what your thyroid hormone levels are or what they're doing, nothing gets done because the instructions can't be followed. So you need iron as an intermediate step within the cell. And then you have a situation where the cells have to respond. And so what is thyroid hormone actually doing? It's controlling the rate at which your cells use oxygen. So oxygen is combined with a calorie, blood sugar, and then those, it's like a car engine. You know, you've got your carburetor, and it's controlling the oxygen coming into the engine along with the, I never know if these car examples are good for women. Are they okay? At any rate, the point being that you have a fuel mixture of oxygen and sugar, and then the engines of the cells, called mitochondria, have to burn and combust this stuff and make actual energy out of it. So that means that your cellular engines have to be nourished. That requires all of the B vitamins. It requires something called Krebs cycle intermediates, which are things like malic acid and others, but malic acid is probably the most important one in terms of keeping the cells going. And factors like magnesium and even coenzyme Q10, which are involved in the final synthesis of energy production. So you have to have this whole process. Now, once the cells make energy, you know, besides the cells being a target, the other thing that's a target of thyroid hormone activity are your muscles. So thyroid hormone itself combines synergistically with testosterone in both men and women and growth hormone to stimulate the metabolic efficiency and function of muscles. So you know, you can determine right away how your thyroid hormone is functioning by your level of physical fitness. This is a very important point. In the final analysis, it's your muscles that have to function right in order for thyroid hormone to be functioning. That's just by definition. So you right away there, you've got a clinical pearl. If you want to improve your thyroid function, improve your fitness. Nobody is going to sit around taking vitamins or thyroid pills or anything else and not become more fit and have actually improved their thyroid function. It isn't technically possible. It just isn't technically possible because your muscles use oxygen. The more efficiently your muscles use oxygen, the more fit you are, and by definition, the better your thyroid hormone is functioning. Now, thyroid hormone is like the drummer in the band. It's keeping pace. It's your basal metabolic rate. It's the rate at which your system uses oxygen at rest. So while you're sitting in the chair here, your thyroid hormone function is governing the pace of your body. If you had to get up and run across the room, thyroid hormone has nothing to do with that whatsoever. That would be adrenaline. And that means whether you're walking across or running across. So a lot of times we think of adrenaline in terms of the fight or flight response. So that's a high level of adrenaline making your body go fast for a need. But a low level of adrenaline, like just walking across the room or carrying in a bag of groceries from the car to your house or whatever, just the everyday activities also requires adrenaline. That is different than thyroid hormone. That's the varying paces of energy expenditure. That's the different crescendos of the different instruments in the band playing. Thyroid hormone is like the drummer. It's keeping pace. Everything in your body is responding to that pace. So thyroid hormone, when it's working normally and it's combusting energy, it takes the calories, the oxygen, the sugar, combusts them, makes cellular energy at the rate of 65%, and heat at the rate of 35%. That's normal energy production in a cell and normal heat production as a byproduct. That's why the most common symptom of the whole pace going too slow is coldness. It's also kind of reflective of what happens when you actually don't have to be doing something based on necessity and you sit down. So if you get home in the afternoon and you sit down and for the first time in the day, you actually don't have to be doing something, and the first thing your body does is conk out, that's low thyroid. Open and shut description of the problem. Because your idling speed doesn't even want to stay on if it's given the opportunity to go off. Now, if any of you fall asleep in this class, you're in trouble. I'm not sure entirely what that means, but I'll think something up. But the point is, we're talking about resting metabolic rate, but it has a profound influence on everything. So every other hormone in your body, the amount that's produced of it, the appropriate production of it at the right time of the day in the right amounts, is all based on thyroid hormone as a fundamental building block. So whether we're talking about stress hormones or sex hormones or growth hormone, doesn't matter what hormone we're talking about, every other one of them is governed by thyroid hormone as part of whatever those hormones issues might be. So that's not the only thing, but it is certainly a basic key factor that's involved. So, you'll see for a lot of times, people will be trying to boost their adrenals to combat stress, and that's important. But at the same time, you'll also see people who take thyroid support and all of a sudden they can manage stress better. That's because the thyroid hormone improvement enabled them to make their adrenal hormones more efficiently. So we see a lot of synergy going back and forth between hormone systems. It's really pretty impossible to separate them. And I think my basic point here in this beginning of the class is that if you are lacking nutrition relating to any step in basic thyroid function, you are going to handicap or stress your thyroid and predispose it to creating other metabolic problems, which then tend to play off themselves in a rather nasty catch-22 manner and progressively lead you into a problem of progressive thyroid issues, other issues, whether it's insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, being overweight. There's a lot of things. It just about anything else it kind of leads to. So you want to make sure you're adequate in the selenium, especially. You also need antioxidants to protect your thyroid gland itself. That's why, the whole idea behind, say, Thyroid Helper and the ISL iodine is that you can have basic amounts of these nutrients available. If you don't eat red meat especially, or if you're a menstruating woman with heavier menstrual cycles, you may need iron. You know, if you're lacking iron, or if your red blood count is down a little bit or something like that, if you're lacking iron, you can have every single symptom of hypothyroidism simply from an iron deficiency. So keep that in mind. I mean, I know many people that will use like blood builder and they just wake up. You know, it's not that they're, that, you know, anemic. They're, you know, because that's what's going on in the blood. We're talking about what kind of iron is in your cells. And so a lot of times that's true. And zinc likewise. So zinc and iron can be pivotal things. Zinc gets used up, again, if you don't eat much red meat, you don't get much in your diet, but zinc is used up by stress. And so women oftentimes need up to 50 milligrams of zinc. Men might need to go as high as 75 in their vitamins to get an adequate metabolic response for thyroid function. Basic multiple vitamin like the Daily Energy, which has all the coenzyme B vitamins and all the Krebs cycle nutrients in it, is fuel for the cells, another important thing. And you know, you can always do extra things. A lot of people need extra magnesium, especially if they're inflamed or in a state of wear and tear. Magnesium, essential for cellular energy production. Coenzyme Q10 can come in handy. And so you see there's a lot of just basic nutrients. And if somebody's saying, well, gosh, you know, and when you've done listening to me, you might say, well, you know, I have every single problem that guy was talking about. And where do I start? Well, you always start with basic nutrients that help the hormone behave, because that's just the most fundamental thing that you can improve. So while I'll talk about a lot of factors that influence thyroid, just remember that the basic things are always the place to start, and make sure you have your ground covered, along with actually hauling your body out and doing some exercise every day and seeing how it responds. And the better your body is responding to exercise, the better it is. Now, a lot of people here, especially when it's colder, you know, I don't know what happens in October or November, but for a lot of people it means, oh, we don't exercise anymore until May. And then it's cold on top of it. So you get this double whammy, you know, because coldness is a stress to your thyroid gland, obviously, because your body has to accommodate the thermal changes. Even going into the cold outside, walking into the warm inside, going back and forth between cold and warm is stressful to the thyroid system. And for a lot of people, it may not bother them that much, but for others, especially if you're on the edge of thyroid problems, you become cold intolerant, you become heat intolerant, you basically become temperature sensitive, which is another key symptom of progressing thyroid problems. The more sensitive you are to fluctuating temperatures or cold, the more you want to pay attention to what might be going on here. Okay, now, thyroid problems are typically linked to a combination of health issues. It is almost never the case that thyroid problems are occurring by themselves. Whether we're talking about leptin resistance, insulin resistance, stress hormones, toxicity, immune function, all of these things interact with thyroid hormone in much a chicken and egg manner. So we see that low thyroid has an important influence adversely on every other hormonal system, but we also see that the other hormonal systems, as well as your immune system and as well as your toxin clearing systems, their efficiency has a huge impact on thyroid. And when these things start going as a trend in the wrong direction, they tend to start fueling each other. Now, as this trend in any given person starts to worsen, then the medical profession starts to be able to observe discrepancies on lab tests. So you'll get labels like hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, Graves, which is autoimmune hyperthyroid, or Hashimoto's, which is autoimmune thyroiditis, which tends to lower the thyroid function. In other words, as your thyroid gland struggles to keep up with whatever is going on, it gets worn down. It gets tired. It gets inflamed. When your thyroid gland gets inflamed and swollen, it's kind of like having a swollen ankle from having sprained it, but instead it's a swollen thyroid gland. Sometimes it actually physically swells. You know, on physical examination at the doctor, or you looking in the mirror, you go, whoa, what's this here, though? It's the thyroid. It's gotten a little swollen. When it swells, your body's immune system responds. Your body's immune system says, oh, we've got swelling, that's an inflammation. Let's send some immune cells into that thyroid gland to try to fix what the problem is, which is a normal physiologic response. And if those immune cells successfully reduce the swelling in the thyroid gland, that is a good thing. If they are unable to do that and whatever the problem is persists, then you start having chronic inflammation, which could be low grade or high grade, and you have chronic infiltration of immune cells into the gland. And those immune cells aren't supposed to be chronically in the gland. So they start to say after a certain period of time, what the heck's going on in here? This tissue is not behaving. It must be malfunctioning. Let's get rid of it. Literally what your body says to itself. And so now you have what is called a degree of autoimmune reaction in the thyroid gland based on chronic inflammation within that gland. And this is, you know, when you start being able to measure thyroid autoantibodies on a lab test. And some people will have this done by their doctors, others won't. Those lab tests are more expensive than the basic thyroid panel, significantly. And so they're often not even done. The doctor just kind of feels the thyroid gland and goes, oh, this is swollen. You have Hashimoto's, even though they have no clue if you have Hashimoto's or not. They just throw a label out, and sometimes you're happy because you have a label, but you really shouldn't be happy with that label because it doesn't really mean anything, especially when it hasn't been verified by an actual test that shows you. Because you as a person would like to know, is this just a basic swollen ankle, or is this a swollen ankle that has immune cells attacking the swollen ankle? And you know, you can't tell that without a lab test. So you get these different descriptions. And then, you know, a lot of times the doctor will say, well, this is off, so we're going to throw in some thyroid hormone now. And, you know, that's nice, except you got to remember that thyroid hormone, even if you feel better taking it right away, thank goodness you do, because now you've found a credit line that works for a while. But you better think of it like a credit score or a credit card, because it's going to reach its limit. Thyroid hormone medication, unless you have blatant thyroid failure or you've had thyroid surgery and had your thyroid removed, is an inefficient way to deal with thyroid problems and doesn't address at all the entire steps or stages of what's supposed to be going on with thyroid, which I just explained to you. So your job as a detective is to figure out what the heck is going on with me and why are there monkey wrenches in my thyroid system. Thyroid hormone is supposed to be released at night while you're sleeping, so right away it's never released then when you're taking it as a drug because you take it in the morning, typically. So you never parallel exactly, you always have an inefficiency with it based on that, and then your body has to cope with a level of thyroid hormone in its bloodstream that it didn't actually put there on purpose. And so that means it has to now deal with a foreign intake of hormone at the wrong time of the day. So even if it's working for you, the whole process is metabolically inefficient. Then, you know, you gotta start thinking about other things. Now, like when research is done on centenarians, I used to call them centurions. Then I realized that wasn't quite the right word. So centenarians, you know, people age 100 or over, what is the difference between healthy centenarians and unhealthy centenarians as far as their thyroid function goes? Well, they certainly don't have elevated autoantibodies, but it's quite interesting. Between the sixth and eighth decade of life in a centenarian, their thyroid hormone slows down on purpose. So the pace of the drummer in the band, instead of clicking along at one of those rap rates of speed that occurs in their 20s, all of a sudden they slow down to classical music that's kind of relaxing. And you say, well, why is that? Well, the reason for that is that as you grow older, your ability to split and divide cells starts to reach towards its potential end limit, which is theoretically, if you're completely healthy, 120 years at this point. And so your body has to calculate how it's going to spend the elderly years of your life. And if you keep up a fast metabolic pace, you're going to keep cell turnover going faster, and you're actually going to die quicker. So it's kind of interesting, but the older you get, there is a element of this where you want actually lessened thyroid activity than you had before age 60 or so. And you might say, well, why does it change then? My guess would be some of the energy dramatic events are over. For women, that would be menopause. For men, that would be andropause. These are huge energy requirements in the human physiology. So the key becomes even more so as you get older, that every other thing that adversely influences thyroid hormone better be gone if you want to be healthy. Because if you're older and you try to make thyroid hormone go faster, you're actually going to inflame yourself. You're going to lose your bone density. In other words, things are going to crumble faster because you're making your metabolism forced to go faster. So think about that the next time a doctor wants you to take thyroid hormone, you know, and wants you to be on it for the rest of your life. You can ask him, well, what happens when I'm 80 and you're giving me this? Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't ever take thyroid hormone. Far be it from me to say that. I'm just saying, ideally, you'd find the lowest possible dose you can even function on and then fix your body. That is what I'm saying. And I'm saying that the idea of more is better, or that having youthful levels of something is the ideal, is clearly not the case with thyroid hormone. You want your pace to be good, and then as you get older, and meaning, you know, somewhere between ages of 60 and 80, you actually want your pace to be slowed down, but you also want that slower pace with an absence of other health problems. That's how you stay healthy. So, you know, we have to think about efficiency of hormones and what they're doing. All right. Now, any medication that causes weight gain is stressing thyroid function. Any medication that causes weight gain is stressing thyroid function. We cannot state that enough. Why is that? Because, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, gaining body weight is a major stress. You can be normal weight or underweight and have thyroid problems. That's not my point. In our current society, we obviously have a problem with too many people overweight. Simply the fact of being overweight induces thyroid malfunction. Now, what happens when a person goes on blood pressure medication and gains 15 pounds? How common is that, by the way? Very. Whenever that happens, the idea of having a blood pressure number better on paper just induced insulin resistance, leptin resistance, and thyroid resistance. You just created major metabolic problems for yourself because you were theoretically keeping your blood pressure number looking better. So this is done all the time. The statin medications, which are given out like candy, and I think someone wants to hand them out at fast food restaurants now. The statin medications. Apparently no statin maker has consulted with the liver's function and why it's making cholesterol in the first place. Cholesterol production is the backbone of survival in the human body. Without cholesterol production occurring, you wouldn't survive a day. Now, yes, you can have too much, and you want to, again, restore efficiency in that system. So I'm not saying high cholesterol is a good thing. But when you turn off the backbone survival system in the human body, which is the synthesis of cholesterol, your body is a system of economy. It makes many things. So you have a production line where at the end of it is cholesterol molecules. But while you're making cholesterol molecules, your body makes all kinds of other things as branching. It's branching out. These are not the direct effects. They're side effects of making cholesterol. One of the side effects of making cholesterol is the direct synthesis of all selenoproteins in your body, every one of them. So your body's ability to make the selenium enzymes that actually activate thyroid hormone are based on the synthesis of cholesterol. And the newest research on selenium, again, this is new, so I doubt you've heard it yet, but the thyroid actually also synergistically governs these selenium enzymes. So you have a synergistic system of cholesterol synthesis and thyroid function driving the production of selenium enzymes in your body, one of which activates thyroid hormone and then makes the system work. You have statins throwing a monkey wrench into that system as an adverse side effect, very powerful adverse side effect. You may not feel it if you're taking a statin right away, but progressively and slowly over time, it interferes with thyroid function. And again, one of the key selenium enzymes that your body makes is called glutathione, which is in the center of every cell and is the most important enzyme for survival of cells and longevity. That is turned down by the statin medications, and turned down by sluggish thyroid function, conversely. So whenever we throw a drug into the picture with an effort to improve some variable, it often has adverse side effects elsewhere. And that's why drugs have such a limited usefulness and are almost never the long-term solution for managing your health. It doesn't matter if we're talking about diabetes drugs or blood pressure drugs or cholesterol drugs. It just doesn't matter. None of them restore efficiency of function in the human body. And if you think you're getting any benefit from them at all, it's short-lived, and you need to replace what they're doing with health. That's an underlying theme of my message. Now, one of the main stressors of thyroid, besides, you know, medications, would be toxins. The thyroid system is extremely sensitive to toxicity, and we live in a very polluted environment. So we have, even if we're doing everything within our power efficiently, we have innate stressors that all of us are experiencing. So the airborne pollution in any major metropolitan area is problematic to the thyroid. Traces of chemicals in the food supply are problematic to the thyroid. And these chemicals were put on the market by an industry that regulates itself. So the people making the chemicals sit on the EPA's advisory boards that decide what chemicals should be allowed in the environment. The animal studies done to determine safety of these are based typically on carcinogenic, cancer-causing properties of these chemicals, studied one chemical at a time. A couple problems with that. We're exposed to hundreds, if not thousands, of chemicals at one time, not one. So the cumulative burden of chemicals on physiology has never really been studied, in the context of allowing these things on the market. Secondly, they've never been allowed on the market in conjunction with what level disrupts your thyroid, ever. Now, your thyroid, let me explain to you why this is such an issue. The enzymes that have to activate thyroid hormone in your liver are based on selenium. I've made that point. The enzymes that clear toxins out of your liver are also based on selenium. So the more pollution you're exposed to, the more your body is forced to use its enzymes to detoxify the poisons. That creates less possible bioavailability of selenium for your thyroid to function correctly, especially if your thyroid, or especially if you're selenium deficient, which is common. In fact, the newest study on selenium, which is quite interesting, showed that not only could it enhance thyroid function, it, with consistent intake, could reduce Hashimoto's autoimmune thyroiditis. Selenium, new study, very powerful. So not only does it help, and the only reason it's going to reduce autoimmune thyroiditis is not because it helped make thyroid hormone, but because it actually enhanced the antioxidant defense system that protects your liver and protects your thyroid. So taking selenium does double duty. My point here, though, is that just the sheer nature of poisons and the amount of them is a stress to the thyroid gland every one of us faces. Now, yes, we can eat organic food, and hopefully that lowers our intake of it. We can not live next to a toxic waste dump, and hopefully that helps us. In other words, we can do things to try to reduce our exposure through our diet, through our water, through what we consume food-wise, but we're still going to be subjected to some. The bisphenol A, which is now ubiquitous in all kinds of things, exposure is not possible. I mean, avoiding exposure can be reduced, but it's not possible at this point because in so many things. That's a thyroid disruptor. There are many chemicals, PCBs, which still, you know, even though they're banned, they're in the ground, they're in the food supply, they're in the water, they're in wherever, they are thyroid disruptors. Perchlorate, which is a waste product of the defense industry, which has gotten into the groundwater in Texas, California, and Florida, and gets into the lettuce, and gets into the grass, and then the cows eat the grass. So you get perchlorate levels in dairy products and in lettuce. So you think, oh, I'm having this great healthy salad, came from California, nice and organic, and it's a dose of perchlorate. I'm not trying to make you not want to eat anything. It's not the goal here. I'm just pointing out that there are a lot of chemicals in the environment that are stressful. Now, a lot of these, just so you understand it, are competitive with iodine uptake in the thyroid gland. They look chemically, structurally, almost like iodine. So that a lot of the pollution is most relevant to anyone who's iodine deficient. This is why you don't want to be iodine deficient, because you can't avoid pollution. So that's why I like the Iosol iodine. You can take a drop or two of that, just rub it over your thyroid every morning or every other morning. Every morning if you notice you feel warmer, especially in the winter, but even every other morning or every third morning, just put on a drop or two and make sure that it'll go right through the skin. Make sure that your iodine levels are being maintained as a defense system against pollution, because it's very, very important. All right, now, the other reasons that pollution is so important is the conversion of T4 to T3 occurs on the cell membrane of liver cells. So it's not inside of a liver cell where this conversion is occurring. It's on the outside of the cell where the actual conversion of T4 to T3 takes place. And that's also the same place that extra pollution and toxins, including alcohol that you consume in excess, bang into the cell membranes. So besides just the mechanics of detoxification, we have the mechanics of a street brawl going on in your liver, where the toxins are punching the cell membranes in the nose, and now the cell membranes, which have bloody swollen noses and black eyes, don't have any functionality left in converting T4 to T3, because it's all happening on the cell membranes of the liver. And even more importantly, which I'll get into later, is that the toxicity, which crosses the blood-brain barrier, directly interferes with thyroid-releasing hormone and TSH and creates abnormalities across the board, both hyper and hypo. And that's some of the most cutting. So we have pollution as a problem, as a stress factor. And this means that your detoxification systems have to be working properly in order for you to not have thyroid stress. So if you're constipated, for example, you're going to have thyroid stress. Why? Because when you don't go to the bathroom every day, then your gut excessively ferments toxins, and they go back into your blood, and they totally wreak havoc with this entire system. So a upset digestive tract becomes one of the most stressful things to the thyroid. When I was doing work early on, the physician I was working with was measuring thyroid autoantibodies on everyone. And I was collecting data on everyone. And there was a direct correlation between constipation and elevated thyroid autoantibodies. Because the toxicity coming from the inflamed off digestive tract is one of the highest sources of pollution that you could ever be exposed to. And it just goes right back into your bloodstream. So, and then it circulates around and inflames the liver, inflames the thyroid, and crosses the blood-brain barrier and disrupts thyroid hormone communication at the most fundamental levels. So we start to see these toxicity issues being extremely important. So adequate dietary fiber, acidophilus, maybe boosting up germ regulators if needed. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do to improve your digestive tract, but improving the digestive tract is also a critical variable for improving thyroid function, and especially if there's constipation. Somebody who is obviously chemically sensitive has a major problem. So the more your sensitivity to environmental chemicals go up, the more you can for sure predict that your ability to activate thyroid hormone correctly in your liver has been stressed, your thyroid gland itself has been stressed, and your brain's production and regulation of thyroid hormone has been stressed. So you want to do what you can to improve the liver function. Liver protection would be essential, and so on. So these these issues are relevant to everyone in general based on pollution, but they become progressively more important to you the more symptoms you have. So the more you struggle with digestive problems, the more you struggle with liver-related issues, toxicity issues, the more you have to focus on those simultaneously to improve thyroid function, because those are things that are punching the thyroid system in the nose. I like to say it's like throwing sand in the gas tank of a car. It doesn't matter if the car is new or old. It doesn't run well on sand. And too much toxic trash in your body is sand, as far as your thyroid system is concerned. Now, there's been some new information on thyroid hormone and fat cells. And, you know, we can look at this several different ways. First of all, leptin levels, and I think most of you probably understand leptin. If not, I don't know why you don't. But Obviously, I talk a lot about leptin, and leptin is the hormone made in your fat cells. When you eat, it's at levels elevate in your blood, and then they go into your brain, and that's how your brain knows you're full. That's how you know you've eaten enough food, the rising leptin levels. When you are overweight or gaining weight and your triglyceride levels are going up too high, it clogs the entry of leptin into your brain. And so even though the leptin levels are high in your blood, they're not getting into your brain, and you don't get an appropriate full signal in the right amount of time, which either means you eat two or three or four or five times what you should eat, or you just feel like you're starving. But the net result is that you don't normally get leptin into your brain correctly. Now, leptin has to not only get into your brain, it has to travel to your hypothalamus gland. And there, when it's there, then it activates the production of thyroid-releasing hormone, which starts the whole thyroid process in motion. So any kind of leptin problem at the central level of your brain is a huge issue for thyroid function, as a, you know, kind of like toxins. It's a cofactor issue. So if you have that issue, it's important. Now, new experiments have shown that when biologically active T3 goes into the fat cells or your white adipose tissue and activates their metabolism, insulin resistance is improved, fat cell activation occurs, and your body starts to work better immediately if you could put active T3 directly into your fat cells. Now, in the case of normal function for people, the active T3 is being made in the liver and then goes to the fat cells. That's how it gets there. This was just an experiment, which was somewhat unexpected how effective it was at lowering blood sugar levels, actually returning them to normal. These are animal studies. But nevertheless, quite fascinating. Conversely, as fat cells expand in size, which is directly reflective of your waistline going up in size, the genes that turn on thyroid hormone function are turned off in your fat cells and turned off in your brain. Not good. Not good at all. So as you gain weight, the weight itself is a monkey wrench in your thyroid hormone function, period. Independent of anything else. Just body weight, because the body weight is reflective of clogged, malfunctioning fat cells. Furthermore, the whole process of metabolism, and this is why thyroid lab tests have very little predictive value of anything. When you are leptin resistant and you're struggling with body weight, the leptin resistance doesn't completely knock out your thyroid axis in your brain. So this, while it throws monkey wrenches into it, it still stays intact enough. And that's because the thyroid axis is linked to the stress axis. So preserving the most survival system of being able to cope with stressors relating to, you know, survival of the species, not only do you have to keep your head awake, your body has to be able to respond to stress. So it's interesting that even when you're having leptin problems, the thyroid system can still function and even give normal lab test scores. But we now know this, that when the thyroid system and you have the overweight problem in the brain, they just discovered this a couple of months ago, in the brain, the leptin thyroid TRH, thyroid releasing hormone system, are turning on all kinds of other metabolic genes completely independent of the basic thyroid axis that result to calorie burning. And all of those turn off, all of them. They just turn off with leptin-related obesity. So the lab test is actually measuring, not very well, but measuring a system of preserved survivalness, but has very little to do with optimum metabolic function, which isn't being measured at all. But you can tell because, you know, your body isn't feeling good. It's sluggish. It's tired. You know, your head is heavy. You try to exercise and you get a bad response to it. You know, your weight doesn't seem to want to budge even though you eat less and try to exercise. You know, these things are reflective of the problem of increased abdominal fat combined with turning off of genes in the brain that activate and stimulate fat burning. That's now been proven. And that isn't tested at all on a TSH, T4, T3 test. The test is your size of your tummy and your energy level. It's pretty simple. You know, I mean, that's that. So, my point here is that the process of weight loss is itself supportive of improved thyroid function, the process of weight loss. So however you want to do it, you want to if you're overweight, you want to engage the process of weight loss as part of your strategy, because that in and of itself turns back on the genes that help thyroid to function better. And I like to emphasize it's the process of weight loss. It's not that you have to get to your goal weight before your thyroid starts to work better. That's not what I just said. I said it's the process of weight loss. That means your body has to be moving in a trend in the right direction. When you create the environment of that trend in the right direction, then the genes start turning on again and the thyroid starts to work better, even though you haven't got to your goal weight yet. So you want to create this process, this environment where you're moving in the right direction. The drug Avandia, which activates PPAR gamma, which I've written several posts about, comparing it to DHA and whatnot, that, of course, was taken off the market because it causes heart disease. And one of the unintended side effects of elevating PPAR gamma with a drug is that it elevates PPAR gamma in the heart, which then causes the heart to overwork and no longer be able to burn fat for fuel and switches to burning sugar for fuel, and the heart then swells and gets fluid retention and becomes sprained from the drug, and then you have heart failure. And so you have this 43% increased risk of heart attack from Avandia. The effect is less from Actos, which is its companion competitor, but still probably there because the mechanism is there. And I point out that DHA, the fish oil, activates PPAR gamma also and turns and has the opposite effect in the heart that the drug does. In other words, DHA actually makes the heart work better and more efficient and actually functions better, even though it's turning on the same exact gene in fat cells that the drug is turning on. It's not doing it in the heart. And you say, well, why is this? Well, nutrition, our bodies evolve with it. And our bodies know how to use it. And so when we're using nutrients to enhance health, we don't have the kind of side effects that the drugs do. So when a nutrient affects the same gene system that the drug does, but yet the nutrient has no side effects, who's even explaining this to the population? Who? Well, me. But who else? I mean, come on. I mean, let's get this, you know, the FDA will not, I don't want to go on an FDA. Okay. My point here about PPAR gamma is it's the PPAR gamma activation in your fat cells, which comes about from eating less food, engaging the process of weight loss. You automatically turn on PPAR gamma doing that. The production of it is enhanced by DHA production. When you turn on PPAR gamma in your fat cells, you turn it on in the brain, which then turns on TRH. So the congestion of stagnant fat cells and the turning off of PPAR gamma actually turns off the brain production of TRH. Critically important. This is why losing weight, if you have that problem, is part of the strategy for improving your thyroid. Now, I want to spend a few minutes talking about TRH. Many of you probably haven't heard a lot about it, but it's thyroid-releasing hormone. I've been mentioning it here today. But TRH has a role, as I've stated, in the production of thyroid hormone by stimulating TSH. But TRH has many, many, many other roles which we are only now learning about. So, and this is what I mean when there is a huge, huge, huge disconnect between what is going on in science and what is going on in a doctor's office. Because if a doctor understood that TRH was probably the single most important compound to have produced in the brain to normalize thyroid hormone function, it would revolutionize endocrinology because it would actually fix problems. I'm not sure that's their goal, but that's what would happen if they did that. They wouldn't have any business. No, it's not true. There'll always be people that need them. But my point is this. TRH, when it is produced under the influence of leptin and under the influence of PPAR gamma and under the influence of nutrients like tyrosine and phenylalanine and under the influence of nutrients like your B vitamins, when you have all of the basic things to get it to be produced in the first place, then it goes all over your brain. And where does it go? It goes right next to the excitotoxic glutamate receptors in your brain, and it acts as a buffer against excitotoxic stress. And the new science shows it is the primary buffer against excitotoxic stress in your brain. If you don't make TRH, your brain is open to the ravages of any stress you're under. If you have adequate TRH production in your brain is protected. That is huge. That is a huge new understanding of what thyroid hormone is all about. TRH also goes to the cerebellum in your brain. And when it goes to the cerebellum in your brain, it controls your coordination. If you don't have adequate TRH production, you're going to be klutzy. You're going to be bumping into things. How many of us ran into a table this morning? I don't know. But keep it in mind. Klutziness equals cerebellum malfunction equals problems. Now, as you get older, and I'm saying, well, you want a little less thyroid activity, that's true, but what you don't want are gaiting problems, walking problems, balance problems. So the centenarians who have the lessened thyroid function don't have any of this kind of problem because they are maintaining an adequate production of TRH for their status. But people who are having neurologic difficulties progressive as they're getting older are at the ravages of a lack of TRH production, which includes coordination, body movement, making them more susceptible to falling, which of course is a huge problem, as well as more susceptible to the inflammatory plaque buildup, which results in cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease. So many of the things which are now happening at an earlier rate in our society are directly related to a lack of TRH production. Now, what causes TRH to go so out of whack? Very interesting studies on this. Two things, take home message, stress and infection. Stress and infection. Now, let me explain why. Infection is obviously the taking over of your body or the attempted takeover of your body by some foreign thing that shouldn't be there. And its goal, of course, is to eat you up, gobble you up, and to recycle you back to carbon. That's not your goal. You'd like to stay carbon and stay alive. So these germs are attacking and inflaming and seeking to undercut you. And so your body's first response to a germ attack is, oh, we have to increase our metabolic rate so we can make immune cells faster. So your body doesn't have a whole battalion just sitting there. That'd be kind of dangerous. Your body has a certain number of immune troops on patrol. That's your white blood count on a blood test. On a blood test, when we're looking at blood tests, we normally want to see the blood test scores in the middle of the normal range. That's kind of optimum. Not so with a white blood count. You want to see your white blood count not low, which means your immune troops are exhausted, but at the bottom end of the normal range. That means you have a baseline level of immune troops out doing something, but they're mostly at rest, you might say. Now, as your white blood count progressively elevates, even if it's smack dab in the middle of the normal range, so a white blood count score on a blood test, basic blood, CBC, maybe it's between 4 and 10, depending on the lab. And you've got your score at 7, so you think, oh, that's normal. No, that's very abnormal. That's, normal is 4. 7 is almost twice as many immune cells. And you don't want that as a baseline. And as your white count goes up when you're not infected, it's a real problem for too many immune cells trying to do things. So that's a lab test. You can kind of predict what might be going on here. Elevations in your white blood count, most simple lab test that you could look at in this regard. But what happens is TRH system in the brain senses signals that determine you're infected. So, for example, bacteria often make the cell wall sheath off an inflammatory toxin called lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. That is a very well-studied compound because it's known to be very inflammatory, very toxic. So when somebody is, quote-unquote, septic or is overloaded by an infectious poison, which is, of course, life-threatening, they have elevated amounts of LPS circulating from the infection itself. Well, as it turns out, TRH responds to LPS by increasing your metabolic rate. Think about it. How many of you have ever noticed that when you're almost sick, not quite sick, I mean, I actually know some people that like to get into this state every now and then to lose a few pounds. You're fighting a bug, but you're not really sick. You can lose 5 pounds. How did you do that? Well, your body increased your metabolic rate to deal with the infection. How did it know to do that? Because it sensed LPS, so it knew an infection was there. So it says, okay, you got to manufacture all these troops because you don't have them. That's normal. Now your white blood count could easily go up over 10 on a short-term basis because you got to have troops to fight the infection, and you've got to, you know, this is metabolic double time. All of a sudden, you got to call to work double time. So your thyroid actually controls that, but not your thyroid gland doesn't control it. Your brain controls it. TRH controls it. It's sensing the toxin. Same thing when you're under stress. What does stress mean? It means I got to run away from a saber-toothed tiger, and I might have to run miles and miles and miles and miles, and I better be able to run really, really fast for a really long time, or I'm going to be dead. That's what stress means on a subconscious basis. Now, you might be sitting in a chair feeling that way. That confuses a lot of things in your body, believe me. But the point is, the TRH neurons are sensitive to this, and the stress actually will increase your metabolic rate in the short term. Because, really, most of life is supposed to be 90% fun and about 10% chaos. But how many of our lives are only 10% chaos? You know, a lot of us are 90% chaos and 0 to 10% relaxation. So we get out of balance. Now, here's the problem. A lot of us have subclinical infections. Subclinical infections. The repeated use of antibiotics, two doses, anytime in 12 months for anyone is adequate to change the bacterial balance of power in their digestive tract towards excessive production of LPS. Periodontal problems are adequate to cause LPS elevations. Every single overweight person, without exception, has elevated LPS in their bloodstream from gut problems, without exception. What does that do? It gives maybe, in the first set of circumstances, a stimulus to thyroid function. But now what they're finding is that after this initial, I'm going to help the body cope with all these extra energy demand needs, it throws monkey wrenches like crazy into TRH production in the brain and TSH production. It influences both systems, and it is complex, and it is chaotic. And the net result for most people is that it crashes the systems. So TRH production in the brain is crashed out by ongoing stress and or ongoing low-grade infections of any kind. And these then cause the deficiency of a primary antioxidant defense system in your brain, which preserves your brain's health. So this extends a thyroid hormone regulating system to all aspects of health and gives a new sense of urgency and importance to the topic, but also a new sense of strategy for those of us who are trying to improve these systems, working on the gut imbalance, working on periodontal dental problems in particular, working on chronic sinus problems, working on any other kind of chronic viral or bacterial infection. You know, you've got swollen glands, you've got a problem. You know, the congested lymph system is a great test of this because that when you get stiffness, pressure building up in your shoulder area where the two major thoracic ducts are, and it's backing up, and now you've got the tightness there, you get the headaches going up the back of the neck, you get the funky head pressures, you know, your arms and hands fall asleep while you're sleeping at night, you wake up with extra mucus in the morning, you got one or all of these symptoms. That is the primary stuck point of internal plumbing. And inflammation in the shoulder and neck area cascades up into the brain and turns off this TRH system. And here's how it does it. The inflammation in the lymphatic system dominoes up into the astrocytes or glial cells of your brain, which are 90% of your brain mass, and inflames them. Once your brain gets inflamed and these glial cells get inflamed, then this other new area of thyroid research is they're called thyroid transporters. Then they don't work functionally, and you can't get thyroid signals from your blood even going to the TRH receptors in the brain. This is also not trivial because we know when the thyroid hormone transport system is disrupted during a baby being born or it occurred in the fetus or in the first few weeks of life, we have mental retardation as a side effect. So we know that the interruption of these thyroid hormone transport systems between the blood supply and the hypothalamus, you know, how you get the signal there is also critically important to this. So this is very, very important information, but it speaks to the process that besides helping your body weight, besides helping your gut, besides lowering any infections, and besides managing stress better, so you have more calmer times, less friction times, you need as a common theme to reduce inflammation. Because all of these things share the commonality of increased inflammation in your system. And so any kind of nutrients, any kind of physical thing you do that reduces inflammation is going to help your thyroid. What would be some of those things? Relaxing activities, hobbies, things you enjoy, getting a good night's sleep, refreshing exercise. These would be the tools in your toolbox, listening to music that's relaxing. Classical music would be top of the list for anybody with a thyroid problem because it soothes your brain. Linda would know which classical music you should be listening to, right, Linda? She's an expert on that. Some of them, those minors, they may not be so relaxing. But anyway, my point is you want to entrain your brain's rhythms to relaxation as a behavioral pattern. You have to have stuff that offsets the stress in your life. So you want to do that. And then you combine with that anti-inflammatory nutrients. Quercetin would be at the top of the list, in my opinion, for thyroid function. Because I used to give quercetin back when I'd see all these elevated thyroid autoantibodies, and it was a primary nutrient that I saw bring it down. That most recent study I was telling you about was selenium. That was bringing down the thyroid autoantibodies in the thyroid glands. That's a clinical study that's just been proven. So selenium, quercetin. I like grapeseed extract. I like resveratrol. We have lots of anti-inflammatory products, that you may be taking for joints, like Jointol or Bone and Joint Helper or Repair Plus. All of these things, or any combination of them, will add to what you need to do to uninflame your body. But when your body is less inflamed, you feel less frictioned in your brain. This is very important. I think when we get right down to the final analysis of it, the best thyroid predictive symptoms are probably brain symptoms. And that would be either a heavy head or a frictioned head. By frictioned head, I mean an irritated head, which would tend to be demonstrated as irritability. So those would be the subclinical symptoms of a functional problem that says you're going down the wrong path. And if you combine those symptoms with other issues of thyroid, then you get the picture. So my point here today, this is actually pretty exciting information about the TRH. It's cutting edge. You won't hear other people talking about it yet. As this talk gets out on the internet and whatnot, you will, of course. Because it's new information that you can use. You want to restore efficiency to this system with nutrition and with lifestyle. And you want to do that so that your thyroid maintains its health. As you go through your 40s, 50s, and 60s, if you have an absence of problems in these areas, then you're going to hit older years with a higher quality of health intact, and you're much more likely to fall into that healthy aging person who has a healthy quality of life as they're aging and really reach the rate of a healthy centenarian. That would be a goal, I think, for some of us anyway that want to live forever, which would be me and maybe some of you, I hope. We're trying to do that. We're going to come back here in 50 years and see how we all did, you know. My point is that when you take the little monkey wrenches out of the thyroid system and restore it to normal, healthy functioning, you are actually fixing the sources of the problems, and they're pretty clear what they are. And so that's what I've tried to give you here today as information. So thank all of you for coming. Very nice talking to you.